The Anton Savage Show on News Talk. The Anton Savage Show on News Talk.
Now we're moving on to the what's going on section of Anton's show that happens, of course, every time. And we've got Hugh O'Connell, who's political editor with the Sunday Times, and also Saoirse Hanley of the Irish Independent, audience editor and columnist. Welcome to both of you.
Good morning.
Morning.
Lots of news as ever, Hugh. And we've got to start with Joe Biden, haven't we?
Yeah, I mean, this sort of ongoing will he, won't he withdraw from the race for the White House, or well, he's in the White House already from the US presidential election. He is coming under a lot of pressure. There's stories this morning and from last night that Democratic donors are withholding $90 million in donations whilst Joe Biden remains top of the ticket. Some wealthy donors have told the largest super PAC that they're withholding this amount as long as the president remains on top of the ticket for the Democrats. This follows, of course, his disastrous debate performance a couple of weeks ago against Donald Trump, and also, you know, he gave a press conference at the end of the NATO summit, where before the press conference he introduced the Ukrainian president Volodymyr Zelensky as President Putin, and then during the press conference itself he referred to his vice president Donald Trump. So these are the kind of verbal gaffes which have been a hallmark of Joe Biden's career for decades, anyway. Really. But there is increasing focus on it because it is clear that, you know, if you look at interviews and media performances that he did even, you know, 2 or 3 years ago compared to now, there's clearly a decline that happens to all of us as we get older.
It does.
You know more about this
Indeed.
Than I do.
Yeah, I know.
And, you know, the White House has been at pains to say that he's, you know, he's fully cognitively sharp and you know, doctors have assessed him and all these things. But even that has become a big story now, the degree to which the White House has tried to insulate the president to such an extent that it's not clear entirely how well he has been performing in the role for the last few years and how engaged he has been and how sharp he has been mentally. So this is a massive problem for the Democrats.
What's your prediction? Go on. I dare you. What's going to happen?
I think it's quite possible at this point that he will be replaced and that Kamala Harris will be the nominee. I think there's a drumbeat growing now amongst Democratic within the Democratic Party for change. We saw George Clooney write an op-ed in the New York Times this week. George Clooney is an actor, some might say, but he's a massive fundraiser for Joe Biden, and he has effectively withdrawn his support from him. And you can see a number of Democratic senators one or two Democratic senators have gone on the record to say he should pull out. A handful of congressmen and women. So the drumbeat is growing. Nancy Pelosi, former Democratic House Speaker, out this week, failing really to say whether she thinks he should run again, which is in itself damning. So I think we're edging towards that.
Yeah, point. The writing's on the wall, isn't it?
The writing's on the wall.
Seriously, what do you make of it? I mean, in my view, it's a bit sad in a way. I mean, we're all watching him, aren't we? And we all stumble. I'm going to stumble several times this morning, you know. But like, I just feel a bit sad. I don't know.
I haven't been able to watch the clips from him during the week because there's just such a sense of like real secondhand embarrassment. But it's not often that secondhand embarrassment is also, you know, in one of the arguably the biggest role in the world. That's what he's gunning for. But I think it's kind of easy to imagine yourself as someone in the States who, you know, is a Democrat or, you know, really wants to be able to believe in that and really wants to, you know, accept they're putting the best foot forward. But there is an obvious sense of real frustration, like from within with the voters as well. Like, I think, you know, that in the very same piece it had said that, you know, 4 in 10 Democrats do think he's mentally unfit for the role, all that kind of stuff. But like, you know, I think 4 years ago, the comedian Bo Burnham released that song that was like, how is the best case scenario Joe Biden? And I think you can imagine 4 years later being like, how is still the best case scenario Joe Biden? You know, but as he was saying, like, if you're to swap to a different nominee at this point, like, what does that look like? How does that work? You know, I think if it's frustrating to watch from afar and obviously not have any real role in it.
What I would say as well is from a strategic point of view, Donald Trump is playing a blinder because we have heard very little from him in the last few weeks because he's just allowing this kind of this crisis upon crisis that is afflicting the Democrats to kind of play out.
Yeah.
And this kind of internal battle within the Democratic Party for for Biden to step down.
And when I'm watching it, you can't focus on what he's saying anymore. You're anxious.
You also can't follow what he's saying much anymore.
Do you think there's ageism going on, Tisha? Because there's an element of, now I know he's obviously impaired, it looks like, sadly, but still, I've seen ageism come across now, and not just about him, but other older people shouldn't be doing certain things. Have you seen this?
I have seen a few talks about that. I think I think the kind of difficulty comes in when you think about like the power that comes with that role, right? Because it's saying like nobody who is, you know, having that experience or in that state that we seem to see him in should have access to nuclear codes. You know, it's like, I think it's really the stakes of the job that make that bigger. But it does raise a lot of questions about like the age at which we're fit to do different things or stick in what we're doing. It's frustrating because in one way you'd love to say like, yes, Joe Biden is that age, but look how well he's doing. Mm. But instead we're seeing the complete opposite of he's that age, but he's also clearly not doing very well at all.
I mean, he seems convinced, utterly convinced that he's the only person who can beat Donald Trump. And indeed, he is the only person to have beaten Donald Trump in the presidential election. I mean, Hillary Clinton couldn't. He did in 2020. And there's a real question to be asked about whoever the Democrats pick to succeed him. I mean, it would, I think, most likely be Kamala Harris, just because of the fact that all of the money that has been raised by Biden would transfer to her. Whereas if they picked another candidate, they'd have to start fundraising all over again from scratch. But, you know, would America be prepared to, it's a horrible thing to say, but it's true. Would America be prepared to elect a black female president? Yeah. I'm not sure. Donald Trump is a manifestation of the reaction to 8 years of Barack Obama in the White House, the reason he became president in 2016. So I think that is an issue as much for the Democrats as Biden continuing, is that actually, if we do this, if we press the nuclear button, if we get him out of the race and we put her in, is she going to beat Donald Trump? And I think there's a huge question as to whether she will.
Hugh, what is wrong with American? Here's a broad statement, a question.
What is wrong?
Why couldn't they find someone else? even at the start of this, people said, oh, he isn't the guy anyway. You know, and surely there must be someone else.
You mean back in
the
Democrat? I mean, don't forget, in 2020, in the run-up to 2020, his campaign was on the ropes for the Democratic nomination. He was kind of polling in third in some of the first primaries, these kind of things. And then he won, I think, South Carolina because the Democrat there, I think Jim Clyburn is his name, he basically went to bat for him. And Biden won South Carolina, and that created a massive momentum around Biden. And he became the nominee, and he beat Donald Trump. But there was always this kind of tacit understanding that he would only do one term. Yeah. But as that has rolled on, he's become more convinced that he's the only guy who can see off Trump. Mm. And I don't think the Democrats necessarily would have expected in 2020 that Donald Trump would be the Republican nominee. But here we are.
Here we are again.
What is wrong with American politics?
That's a bigger question.
I can't answer
that question.
It's a whole other segment. Yeah.
Have you seen that piece issue in the Irish Times? Ian Robertson, my colleague, there's four types of Trump voters, apparently.
Yes.
What do you make of that? I mean, they're trying to find out who votes for Trump. Now, a lot of people are going to vote for him, obviously.
Yeah. Well, it's interesting because I think, like, particularly the second time round, I do think that there's a lot more. I think a lot of people, you'd hope anyway, would have slightly turned away from him. The more casual Trump voters, I think, you know, there's not a lot that can withstand the 4 years that Trump's had in and out of courts and, you know, mugshots and all kinds of things. But the piece outlines that there's, you know, there's the kind of mega rich, there's the Christian right, there's the J.D. Vance hillbillies, and then the celeb outlaws, you know, the celeb outlaw fans who think this is, you know, a kind of a great story. But I do think what it slightly ignores is the surprising apathetic Trump voters. Like, I was living in New York in 2020, and I was living with a really lovely, you know, woman, a friend of mine she's from Arizona, I believe. And we, you know, were sharing very close living quarters. We got really close. We're good pals. And I would have thought we were aligned on everything. Like, politically, we seemed really, you know, on the same page. And it came out like 2 months into living together that she had voted for Trump. And she was saying, like, God, she'd never do it again. And I was like, but what? You seem really rational. What were you thinking? And she just said, well, I didn't really think much about it. And my parents were. So I just did the same. And I think that it's hard to ignore the fact that there are still, I would hope not so much this time around, because, as I said, there's been a big 4 years for Trump. There's been a lot of kind of realities for people and a lot of kind of light shone on, not that he wasn't already, we already knew what kind of person Trump was, but I think it's become more evident in the past 4 years that you would hope people would turn away. But there is still an undeniable fact that the four people that Ian Robertson outlines are likely to always stick by him. And that's the trouble. They're the kind of...
And in that piece here, I read it, it's a worry because Project 25 is coming, right? If he becomes president, there will be an expansion of presidential powers. Now, that strikes me that he wants to be a dictator, does he? Well, at least push certain things
Project
to give 20, him more
25
power.
Is this kind of radical blueprint that's been drawn up by this organisation called the Heritage Foundation, which outlines a kind of a massive expansion of presidential power, sacking lots of civil servants, abolishing lots of federal agencies, repealing lots of environmental legislation. It would include appointing kind of acting heads of departments so that they wouldn't have to be confirmed by Congress. Trump has sort of distanced himself from this during the campaign, but, you know, can we believe anything that Trump says? He's consistently shown himself to tell lies and untruths. But what struck me about this piece as well is that, like, one of the reasons that Trump has this kind of loyal band of supporters is he has delivered for them. He delivered for the Christian right. Yeah. He packed the Supreme Court with conservative judges. He got three judges, I think, onto the Supreme Court, which is extraordinary, really, in 4 years. They've abolished Roe v. Wade. That's a huge victory for the Christian right and for people who are anti-abortion. And equally, he delivered massive tax cuts for the super wealthy in America who've benefited massively from that. So from that perspective, amidst all the chaos of his administration, the fact that he is now a convicted felon, as president, he delivered for those voters. He got things done.
Well, like you say, I know people in America where I go and they say they're Trump voters, and I'm going, "What? Why is that?" It's mainly because I don't want to pay tax. It's very simple, isn't it?
Yeah, there's a very different mindset in America about tax than there is in this part of the world, I think. Yeah.
We'll move on from Trump, will we, Tish, and talk about the Indo front page, Ministers at War. There's a great headline for you over the €400 million bailout for RTE. What do you make of this RTE situation that's got still running, by the way, the RTE story?
Yeah, no, I think we've been on RTE for a long time to come. I think it's really interesting about the TV licence being this real, like, thorn in the shoe of RTE, or thorn in the shoe, thorn in the floor, rather. And it's not really...
That's a Biden slip there, by the way.
I'm unfit.
I'm watching both of you now.
They're dragging me out of the studio as we speak. But, you know, it's something that has been a problem for years, and I think will continue to be, because there is no clear answer. You know, it was rejected in that meeting, as Fionnuala sets out, that they're not going to just get rid of the TV licence. That Catherine Martin had called for that, and they're saying, no, it's not going to happen. They're going to, you know, the TV licence will stay. But I think what they had suggested was a kind of a bailout package that would see like €1 in €8 of the money being offered going to RTE, which, as Fionnuala says, is just like a really naive and an extreme kind of suggestion. But I suppose the difficulty now is in deciding whether or not, you know, the balance, I suppose, of what comes from the Exchequer and what comes from the taxpayer. And no one at all seems to have the answer for it. And I think they can't seem to decide how much goes where and where it comes from.
Yeah, this is a fight that will continue, I imagine.
I think so.
And huge, it costs, it was revealed in the article, €255 million per year to run RTE.
Well, yeah.
That struck me as a very interesting, now I don't know what that, it could, maybe that's not enough, I don't know, but it seems like a lot of money to me.
It is a lot of money, and it's the reason why there's been such a vigorous debate in government with an awful lot of people, an awful lot of ministers, the Taoiseach, the last finance minister, Michael McGrath, the current finance minister, Jack Chambers, Pascal Donoghue, the public expenditure minister, arguing for the retention of a payment that householders would make in order to fund public service broadcasting, primarily RTE, whereas Catherine Martin argues for full-on Exchequer funding. But as Saoirse pointed out, I think the argument that was made at the meeting this week was that if we are increasing public spending by €1.8 billion next year, and we're allocating €1 in €8 of that towards RTE, that's not going to sit very well with voters. And it's going to mean that other things don't get done in terms of increasing other, increasing welfare payments, helping out vulnerable during the winter with their fuel costs, these kind of things. So I think people are pretty sick of this debate now. They just want the government to make a decision. The latest we hear is the government's going to make a decision before the end of July. It's the 13th of July. So look, it's coming pretty close. And I think it's going to land in a situation where they're going to retain the license fee in some way, shape, or form. They're going to reform it, maybe reduce it by 10, 15 euro. And they're going to get revenue to collect it. And revenue are much better at collecting than on post, quite frankly, to collect the license fee.
And change the name of it, it looks like.
Probably change the name of it.
Yeah, I'd love to know what the suggestions are for that, like what they're changing it to.
But one thing I think is really important just to add as an addendum to all of that, a decision will be taken. It will require legislation. I think the government might run out of time to legislate for this if there's an election either later this year or early next year. I don't think the legislation will get done, therefore we will probably be having this debate again.
And they probably know that. They're kicking the can down the road.
Well, yeah, they probably, in their subconscious, they probably know that,
So do we need RTE? I mean, I know we need them for something. But here we are in news time.
Yeah, yeah.
We don't get any money, you know. So this is totally commercial.
I think
station,
it is interesting, but. Like that, you know, and a lot of other like publishers and companies around the country think the same. That like, you know, we're all kind of fighting for the same corner of the pool, and it's difficult when you do have a body that is getting two streams of that revenue. Yeah. Like, you know, there's always been calls for, okay, well, rely entirely on that money and take away the advertising revenue. And but then there's huge, you know, pushback against that as well.
Yeah.
So I think like it's something that it's very easy for those of us who aren't in RTE to be like, absolutely, give the money to us, you know, absolutely. Yeah. And there is something to be said for balancing the playing field a little bit. But at the same time, if you're a public service broadcaster, they do have other, you know, they have other responsibilities that the rest of us don't have to kind of meet in the same way. And, you know, where's the, how does that work financially then if you change it all up, you know?
I mean, I think the issue is like Sirish and I both work for organizations that have subscription models and rely on people paying for the journalism that we produce. And RTE, you know, gives it away for free online.
Yeah.
That is, that rankles with an awful lot of people who work in the industry, I think.
Yes,
it does, yeah. Now, we've got a couple of texts coming in. The Biden issue isn't an ageist issue. My dad didn't want to stop driving and it was up to the people around him to step up and do what's right. The Democrats need to do this. Another one, Kamala Harris is an underperforming no-show and doomed to lose to a far superior and experienced Trump. That's from Lara in Dublin. He was obviously not a fan of Kamala Harris. Now, that's the weather next year. We've got to talk
weather.
About it. Where would we be if we didn't have the weather
it's
to talk?
True.
It's neutral.
There's yeah.
There'd be no controversy.
You'd never
here.
Have any small talk with anyone if we just talking about the weather.
Now, two friends of mine from Australia are visiting, by the way, and they're listening in, I think. That's Mark and Robin. And they've just spent the last 2 weeks in the west of Ireland. They can't believe how bad the weather is here because they've been soaked to the skin. But the headline said, heat waves, hopes dampened in the Irish Daily Mail by grim July forecast.
Were any of us really hopeful? I think is the question I have there. You know, there's been a lot of reports the last week or two saying like, oh, like summer hasn't started. It is mid-July. Yeah. So I would think that summer isn't going to start if it hasn't already. Right. That said, you know, maybe in August we'll get a kind of spell. But yeah, it definitely looks like certainly for the rest of the month that we're seeing rain, grey clouds and not exactly a sunny spell that we expected. But I think to me, it doesn't seem very surprising because I never have very high hopes each summer that we're going to see much. But it is demoralising when you've got friends abroad who are in beautiful, sunny, wonderful places and you're bringing an umbrella to work on a July morning.
It's a great topic.
Oh, it is, yes. It's very depressing though. I mean, last July was appalling. It just rained the entire month. So, you know, it hasn't been that bad this month in comparison to that.
No,
But yeah, look, I mean, I did read a couple of weeks ago that the first couple of weeks of July, that there was expectation they were going to be pretty good, but that's obviously not really transpired. It is unseasonably colder than it usually is at this time of year.
Does it feed the climate change debate here? Obviously, it is. Now, of course,
these
short-term things. In other words, this terrible weather is because of
what, you know, I look at this from kind of the political angle and in terms of voter concern about climate change, I think that kind of ebbs and flows. And really, that concern is heightened when we have extreme weather events. And we, this year, correct me if I'm wrong, we haven't really had an extreme weather event that has shut down the country or, you know, major flooding that has caused like untold damage. I know we had Middleton, I think that was last year. Yeah. But, you know, absent that, we just have this kind of rain that doesn't really cause like huge damage, but is like just very demoralizing to our national mood.
Yeah.
But I don't necessarily think it kind of, you know, makes people more concerned about climate change.
I think it makes them less because, and it's frustrating in a way because people can be quite literal about climate change and be like, oh, well, it's raining in July, so there's definitely no problem. The world isn't going to burn.
Yeah, things are normal.
Exactly. Whereas like realistically, like, you know, you look at anywhere else in the world and there are very extreme weather events happening still. Like you look at some of the states and there's, you know, babies dying on boats on the 4th of July because it was too hot for them and all this kind of stuff. And I think it's annoying when the weather is bad in the summer because it doesn't help people who don't really believe that climate change is as big a problem as it is. It makes, you know, it's very easy to be like, it's fine because look outside, it's raining, it's grand. But, you know, it's very much not grand, even if it's raining.
I have seen projections here of what the climate's going to be like in 10, 15, 20, 30, 40 years' time, right?
Yeah.
And one thing is we'll be able to grow grapes in Ireland.
Right.
And there may well be Chateau Wicklow or Chateau Limerick.
You never Irish know. Wine could be nice.
It has to be an upside, doesn't there?
Well, absolutely, yeah. And then, you know, we can use the revenues raised from that to pay for flood defences, right?
And in terms of the politics, it waxes and wanes. This issue keeps...
I think it does. I mean, look, you saw the Green Party vote in the local and European elections. They didn't have a great election.
No.
They didn't lose all their seats. I don't think they'll lose all their Dáil seats. They have 12. I think they might come back with half that in the next general election. But I guess the key thing really is that to have that sort of green agenda, this government has been the greenest government ever, not green enough for some climate activists, but nonetheless it is put in place, I think, the legislative framework that will radically change the way in which we deliver infrastructure in this country over the next 10, 15 years, and we'll do so in a more climate-friendly way. But also, I think, you see the EPA report this week, which showed, I think, that emissions were down last year. So there is progress like that, you know. But it's not coming as fast enough as it needs to.
But do you think the Irish government have done well compared to other governments?
I think they have, yeah.
They seem to be well-regarded, don't they, in terms of what they've... I mean, as you said, they could do more, but they've achieved a certain amount, haven't they?
No, they certainly have. But, I mean, you have to ask yourself, in the grand scheme of things, what we do, does it necessarily impact the planet as much as what, you know, India, China, America... the big polluters who are not going near us far enough. And we're just talking about Donald Trump. I mean, if he abolishes the EPA...
We're going to go backwards.
We're going to go backwards in a really big way, yeah.
Now, here's a clip. Wait till you hear this clip. Now, we're moving on a bit more lighter.
I remember that day. I never forgot it. But a slave could take revenge against an emperor.
Where were you born?
I don't know. I never knew a mother nor a father.
You will be my instrument.
Who are you?
Now, who was that? That's Paul Mescal. You wouldn't recognise his accent.
No, you wouldn't. I really like Paul Mescal, but I've not been fond of his accents in the past couple of films he's been in. I don't know, is it because we all know he's from Kildare, that it's really hard to take that away. But I just can't believe him.
I couldn't pick up any Kildare there, could you?
I can't get behind it. But having watched the trailer, I do think that I have slightly more hope for his accent this time around. But yeah, Paul Mescal.
That's Gladiator we're talking about, by the way.
Yes.
There's a fair few stories on this one that can he do the job? He's going to be lead in this movie. That the trailer's come out and it's been slammed.
Yeah.
That classic tabloid word apparently is not great. And the question I'm going to ask you is, do you think Paul Mescal can carry a movie? Because obviously it's a big job, isn't it, to carry Gladiator 2 following on from Russell Crowe's great performance.
Very true. And I think no matter how much I have given out of his accent, I do think, despite that, his performances have been really strong over the past couple of films, that I do believe that he could really do that. And I think it's part of a strong cast overall. Like, if you've got Pedro Pascal and Joseph Quinn there as well, I think you'll kind of make it work. But I was just saying to you before we came in that I watched Gladiator for the first time last night.
Did you?
Yes, knowing that it was going to be on the billing today, actually. But I watched it for the first time. It just it skipped over me as I was growing up. I never got into it. I watched it.
You can't beat it, can you?
No, it was brilliant. It was great. And Russell Crowe was brilliant. And I can't I can't imagine, though, like, obviously they're big shoes to fill. And clearly there's a lot of kind of legacy around this film, and people are obviously therefore frustrated with some of the changes. But I think of all the changes, having Paul Mescal in the lead, I don't think you're going to lose out there.
That's a good move, isn't it? Hugh, what do you think? I mean, Colin Farrell famously fell on his face with Alexander. He was the same age as Mescal is now, by the way, and they were hoping Farrell would carry that whole movie, and he didn't, you know.
Yeah.
Do you think Paul has the necessary
I think he does. Skills. I thought the trailer was great. I see people complaining about, you know, it gave too much away. Every trailer does that, arguably. I'm really looking forward to seeing this film. I want to watch Gladiator again. I've seen it hundreds
thousands
of times.
So
thousands, not thousands, but definitely I've seen it a lot.
More than you.
Can you believe she'd never seen it till yesterday?
Well, this is the age discrepancy we're just talking about.
Exactly
what
it is.
This film was produced like 25 years ago. And it was released in 2000. And I mean, I was a teenager at that point. And
I was three.
You were three.
I was three.
So, I grew up watching Gladiator. I haven't seen it in years, though, actually. And actually, what it did, this trailer did make me want to do is go back and watch watch it again. And then I'll definitely be going to the movies to see this one.
I think so.
And I thought the trailer was great. And it has all of the elements.
Escapism, hopefully. You know.
It has all of the elements of a great film. So.
Now, we got a hand to the paw. BAFTA winner, Academy Award nominee, maybe. Win an Oscar, like Russell Crowe.
Yeah, maybe.
What do you think?
I don't know. I'd love to see that. Like, we've had a really good run of Irish actors
wouldn't
doing spectacularly well. I think we're
Killian
brilliant.
Won it. Why wouldn't
he also win them much earlier. Yeah.
That's right. Yeah, keep our fingers crossed. Now, we have to talk about the football. Are you going to be watching it on Sunday,
no.
tomorrow?
I am not. I'm going to be really glad that the Euros is over.
Are you going to be really glad? Oh, God.
Yeah. I'll get my friends back, my boyfriend back. It's going to be brilliant. I can't wait.
Well, there you have it. You've got to watch the final.
I do have friends watching
it's
it.
It's a big occasion anyway.
My sister is in Spain at the minute and she is heading to a beach to watch it on a big massive screen with everyone else, and that I think is the nice. That would get me to watch, I think.
Yeah. But, yeah, it's a big occasion.
I think I'd feel left out if I didn't watch, so I might have it on.
Now, Hugh, what do you think about the in the papers as well? Do you see should we support England?
Yeah, there's a lot of that. I mean, I'm very clear about this. I just find it impossible to support England. And of course, I great contradiction. I support a Liverpool. I support an English football team. All of these things, but. The getting behind the England national team is just not in my DNA.
It's a step too far.
It's not in my genetic makeup.
So will you be chanting ole, ole, ole for Spain?
Well, no, I won't be chanting. No. But I mean, I'll definitely be wanting Spain to win. Spain have been the best team in the tournament. I mean, they've won all their games. England struggled through the group stages, really struggled.
Did you watch much of it?
I've watched a lot of it, much to my wife's annoyance. Spain have been really good in this tournament. They've been, I think they deserve to win. But there is a vibe about England that suggests their name is on the cup. They looked like they were going to go out against Slovakia. They an overhead kick in the 95th minute, 96th minute. They got through against the Swiss, and against the Netherlands the other night, they got a break with a penalty that maybe wouldn't have been given in other circumstances, and then a last minute goal. So. There is a sense that their name could be on the cup. But
can you imagine how painful it's going to be if they win?
Well, you see, you're like me, Luke.
It'll be 1966 again.
They'll never shut up about it.
That aren't like us, people that do, are happy to support it, I'm not sure.
Oh, I think so.
I think there are some people in Ireland who will support England. But the argument's always thrown back is, well, you know, from English people, I have English friends, you know, will we support Ireland and we support Scotland when England are not playing or whatever? It's not the same.
It's not the same.
It's not 800,
less,
800 years
baggage.
Of oppression, all these things.
No comment. No comment. No, Hugh and Saoirse, thank you very much.
Thank you.
For
thank
that
you.
Very interesting discussion.
The Anton Savage Show on News Talk.